Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Open Book, your weekly spiritual book club. I'm Lori Strawn, and with me, as always, is my good friend Alice Shelton. Hi, Alice.
Hello, Lori. Happy Thanksgiving week.
Happy Thanksgiving. Today we're going to dive into something a little unusual for us. In his book, Murder by Candlelight, author Michael Knox Barron puts forth the theory that we have grown less and less shocked by murder, and that this is both reflected in and influenced by the literature that we read and the media we see. Murder has gone from an act so shocking it couldn't be shown on stage to something that's portrayed as something you can deal with fairly easily through social science and competent detective work. Here is our first and only quotation of the day. Evil loses a good deal of its horror when you succumb to the illusion that it can be done away with by means of better plumbing or a saving pill, the establishment of a more intelligent school curriculum, or a reformation of the gene pool. The more one gets into the habit of thinking of evil as a byproduct of social or economic circumstances, or as an anomaly in the neural architecture of the brain, the harder it becomes for one to take it seriously as a permanent element in the soul, one's own included. The first principle of goodness, it would seem, is to accord evil a healthy respect. Evil, if it be really evil, has in it something of the shadowy and indistinct. It is enveloped in an obscurity which the poet or the prophet may partly penetrate, but which the light of reason and science can never wholly dispel. There is that in it which passeth understanding. The rational or empirical investigator affects to solve the mystery of a particular evil when he has, in fact, but grazed the surface of its horror. It is as though he had lit a candle and, pleased with the little circle of illumination he had made, flattered himself that he had vanquished darkness. But here's our first question, Alice. Why are human beings so interested in evil? How and why do we try to understand it, and what do we gain from that?
Well, I can speak to really only why I try to understand it. If I can explain an act, a murder, a bomber, a suicide bomber, for myself in saying that person has some mental problem, and or, you know, if I can find a concrete, believable, viable argument for myself that would explain the behavior, as the quotation says, then I can rest assured and mark off my own list that, hey, I don't have da-da-da-da-da. I'm not involved in da-da-da-da-da. So therefore, I can distance myself from it. It's not going to happen to me. I'm not going to do it. And then just kind of cocoon myself with that information. So I think that's part of it. It's just a way of distancing ourselves from it. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And finding neat boxes to put it into. And I think we do try to pin it down and get a handle on it every way we can. And maybe that's why crime shows are so popular, because we just keep trying to examine it from every angle, even though it may be something that cannot be really examined. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're trying to nail it down and make it scientific and make it solvable. I mean, you think about just the election process, if you could step out, speaking of something evil, you think about the election process and the responses of the candidates trying to make a very complex, multifaceted, international situation fit into a five-point PowerPoint execution strategy. I mean, you know, nothing is that simple. And so, which in some ways is why I kind of go easy on sitting presidents, no matter how good or bad I think they are, because I think the average person has no appetite for the complexity of things. For us, it's very black and white, and that's just not true. I don't know. That's kind of my general answer. I had something else, but it'll come back to me.
Okay. Well, do you think that the notion that evil loses its horror when one tries to fix it as a social solution, what do you think about trying to fix evil in that way, as, you know, through better education, through pills and, you know, advocacy and all that sort of thing? Shouldn't we try to fix things that are broken?
Again, a real complicated question, because for me personally, the thing that this quotation and this reading did for me was it made me really say, do I believe in evil? You know, and what power does evil have? And so that's a question that I think you ask yourself and you grapple through time and time again in your life. I would love to believe there is no evil, that, you know, there are no evil people, there are just people who are mentally ill or who've had circumstances that have altered their lives. But I think that's naive. I mean, I think as I get older, I do think there is something to be said for acknowledging and respecting respecting in a good way, but having a healthy respect for the presence of evil and of needing to do things in one's life to distance oneself from participating in evil as much as possible. So I think it's a both-and answer. I think we have to, as individuals, come within ourselves to understanding the power of evil and doing what we can individually. But I think there are some systemic things, Lori, that can support moving away from evil. Now, I think we will find wide disagreement about what those things are. And they're
right.
Not going to stamp out evil. But I think
exactly.
I'd rather focus on, you know, good, healthy social service type options. Not even social service necessarily, that doesn't have to be called, but positive things rather than shutting borders down and putting armed guards in airports and things like that. I mean, I'd rather figure out constructive ways to help people be together and know one another and work together in those ways.
Right, because, I mean, let's face it, what works universally? Nothing. Death penalty doesn't stop murders from happening. There's no pill that can fix a psychopath. Most sex offenders will reoffend. You can lock them up. You can give them therapy. Most of the time, they will reoffend. We keep trying to fix something that can't really altogether be fixed because we don't know what else to do with it, I think.
Right. Well, and I mean, there's a lot of societal cost to dealing with it. And therefore, I mean, I think a lot of the solutions have to do with managing the societal liability that it plays. I mean, you go into the whole church sex scandal. I mean, that's multifaceted and complex, but at least in part, I have to believe there were some pretty large financial things going on that there was liability that had to be mitigated against, you know, and you hate to think in terms of that, but I think that, and certainly money is a huge root to evil in human beings, potentially the biggest one. I mean, money and probably the sexual impulses that we have are, not that the impulse is evil, but the behaviors that result in uncontrolled reliance on or acting on the impulse can be very devastating.
Yeah, it does really boil down to dollars and cents, doesn't it?
A lot of it does. I mean, and there, I think you could make the case that paring down some of the disproportionate wealth and poverty in our country from both ends of the spectrum could potentially mitigate some of the difficult behaviors. I mean, I think the national news, we talked about this last week, the national news picked up the local murder of a young pregnant woman who's a pastor's wife, and they've arrested the guy who shot her this week, allegedly. And, you know, the article in the paper talked about this gentleman being a member of a gang called, like, Always After Money was what the, the initials of it stood for. And I just thought, or it was FAM, you know, Forever After Money. And I just thought, oh, there's, you know, money does have some difficult things.
Yeah. Gosh, I didn't know that. Well, moving on. The author seems to think that as a society, we sort of diminished horror by the way we portray it. And he gives the example of, I don't know if you've ever read Henry James's The Turn of the Screw.
Uh-huh.
It has no violence, no gore. It may not even be happening except in the mind of its protagonist. And he compares that to more current things like American Psycho by Bret Easton Ellis, which is blood-soaked, graphic, gory. And he says somehow The Turn of the Screw is more frightening. Do you agree?
Huh. Well, I have a pretty low tolerance for blood and gore and violence and just loud noise. And I mean, there's a lot on television that I just cannot really watch, even if the volume's off. So I may not be the best person to answer this, but yeah, I mean, for me, psychological evil and is more frightening and insidious than physical violence is, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is because I cannot really see myself. I don't know that I know anybody who's really ever been a victim of physical violence. I mean, maybe I do and I've forgotten, but I just can think of more situations where I've met people who feel psychologically not all there. I've been in circumstances where that's there. So for me, yeah, that is more scary. But I do think most people have become pretty immune to connecting anything on the television or the big screen with reality.
Mm. Interesting.
I mean, be it love stories or not. I mean, I just think I think people are disconnected from it.
Well, there is that. And that, you know, being desensitized by violence. I was just thinking of, again, it's kind of like sexiness. You know, back in the old days when a woman would flash her ankle and men would go crazy. And nowadays,
right.
I mean, it's all out there. You can see anything you want, but it's just kind of gross and gratuitous.
Yeah.
You know, I keep thinking of, in Macbeth, Duncan's murder happens off stage. We never see the murder, but we see the effects that it has. And you see what it does to people and how it changes them and what it turns them into. And that, by far, to me, is way more scary than anything you could show me of, you know, someone stabbing someone or shooting somebody. I can think of things that are worse in my head. I can imagine things more frightening than anybody's going to be able to write or put on a screen.
Yeah, I think you're right. I would agree with that. You know, while we're a little bit in the subject of the media and the news and the just Hollywood thing, one area of that media that I still think is doing a very good job of representing tragedy and what is really happening in a way that evokes appropriate and lasting emotion in me, at least, would be professional photographers who are, you know, still photography for me is much more haunting and lasting and impactful than anything on the nightly news, anything in a movie. And I think this morning there was a picture in the paper taken in, I think, New York in the airport, and it was of an armed U.S. police officer with what appeared to be a high-level assault rifle. I mean, you know, a rifle, not a gun, visibly holding it in the stance of being prepared to shoot in an airport near the security area, not in an altercation, but at rest while passengers were going through. Lori, I remember going into Italy and going into the airport in Rome and being affronted by seeing armed guards, and I never thought I would see that in the United States, and that really took me back this morning. So pictures are impact. Pictures convey more reality to me, I guess, than a lot of the other media presentation.
Boy, that is a good point, and I never thought about that. You're right. That may be one of the last bastions of appropriate response, because it does leave some mystery. It leaves some interpretation open to the viewer.
Yeah. Yes, and it allows us to, it does. It allows us a different entree to the situation. It allows us to walk around it a little bit, see it from the perspectives we want. And, you know, I've always, and I don't think that's just in terms of negative, violent things, because I certainly have seen photographs in recent months of the blessing and good things that come from people, and I mostly get those from still photography. You know, the look on a person's face who's helping a child, or, you know, feeding the hungry or whatever. So I think it's both and.
Agreed, because you don't have, you know, some news anchor sitting there projecting saccharine thoughts onto you. You know, you can have the genuine emotion yourself.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it. You know, a steady diet of the news of any sort, whether it's Fox, CNN, your local channel, NPR, it is, I find myself just teasing through it, trying to get, it's like being in a jungle, saying, what is truth? Whose perspective is this from? What else are they not saying? I mean, it's just, it makes me nuts.
Yeah. Well, why do you suppose we keep ramping up the horror in movies and books? And is there any way to step back from that precipice, do you think?
Well, I think we keep doing it because it's clearly selling. So the appetite for it is a pretty open marketing. Lori, I think, and I don't know what other countries are like, but I think in this country we have so much wealth. We have so much free time, relatively speaking. We have so much idleness that we just are trying to fill time. I mean, I think we feel so out of control that we can't feel anymore unless things are just so extreme that it's like it's yanking the emotion out of us. I mean, we have become so dulled to anything that is not, you know, beeping on our cell phone or that's probably oversimplifying it, but it's almost like we have develop such a callous against everything that nothing affects us. I mean, we just keep more and more things to try and get some emotional feeling. It's like drug, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of we're upping and upping our tolerance so much.
Yeah, I mean, look at... Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, it's. I mean, you can make the same. I think you can draw the same analogies within the church world. I mean, and this is not a criticism of what people are searching for in church. I think it's an observation. The Protestant world, in particular, and I even see it in the Catholic world. I assume it's in Jewish synagogues, whatever. You know, church services are being marketed and treated, in my mind, a lot like entertainment. You know, huge mega churches with huge screens that are playing, you know, Christian rock music, and there's videos and there's PowerPoints, and, you know, pastors in Protestant churches, I think, are probably under enormous pressure to be outstanding preachers and to every Sunday outdo themselves. And, you know, at what point does that become a performance for people to just have another venue for entertainment? I mean, I don't like the big screens, particularly in churches. I mean, even Catholic churches are doing those now. And it's kind of like, guys, this isn't a movie theater. I mean,
yeah.
Haven't
we heard for years people complaining that, it's all bread and circuses. You know, we're inured to tragedy. Hasn't that kind of come up before in other generations going back and back that we seem dulled by modern culture? If that's true, then what is the cause? If it isn't because we're staring at screens all the time, if it isn't technology, then what is it?
Well, going back to the beginning of our conversation, it's the power and pervasiveness of evil in human life. That it has to, I mean, it's going to manifest itself in some way in all generations. I think.
Is it just part of the human condition? that there's a part of us that requires more and more stimulation?
Yeah, I really think there is. I mean, I think there is an innate searching in human beings, an innate hunger, hole, whatever you call it. And while some people know that the searching for that, if it doesn't ultimately lead to some spirituality or some greater power, I call that God, Christianity, some people call it other things, that there is going to be emptiness and there's not going to be filled or sated desire for human beings. I mean, to me, that's kind of what evil is. It's just the continued unfulfillment, lack of fulfillment of the human desire for completeness. You know, wrongly placed
evil
desire for completeness. Yeah.
Well, what about, okay, this is another thing that this author brings up, the popularity of whodunits, in which the bad guy, who, you know, is clearly a bad guy, is always caught, always justly punished, and is never a person like you or me. Does that, you think, help or hinder us in our apprehension of evil?
Well, I think if anything that is going to allow us to continue to place ourselves as outside the possibility of evil and protected from it and not complicit in it, probably is what the benefit of those things would be for human beings. It's just a way of allowing us to distance ourselves from it.
Yeah.
It's a protection.
I mean, even in the movies where, oh, the psycho killer is dead, but we know he's coming back because there's going to be a sequel, there's that false assurance that maybe you can't squelch evil, but you can at least put it off for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I mean, we talk about evil as human acts or identifiable acts, but I think about some of the major national disasters that have been happening, weather-related or environmentally related things. And I've been conscious of just some of the scripture I've read lately. I would not describe myself as an end times Christian. I mean, the book of Revelation is not my deal. I had a roommate after college who was very much into the end times and was forever telling me, you know, how the people are all these reasons why I should be seeing the second, you know, the end of the world coming. But recently, with what's been going on in Paris and other parts of the world with ISIS, it's probably the first time in my adult life as a conscious awareness that I have said to myself, something feels different to me here. Something feels more insidious than it has felt before.
Hmm.
Do you have that feeling?
I think everybody goes through that at some point in their life. I think, you know, when Kennedy died, a lot of people felt that, you know, or when Martin Luther King Jr. died in the 60s, there was a lot of that feeling. So, I think in everybody's life, there comes a point where you start feeling, okay, this feels different to me.
Yeah.
And maybe the world is going to just keep going on like that and the next generation will have their moment. And maybe not. We don't know.
No, we really don't. And I have no desire to live in fear. I mean, I think that's another piece of the whole media thing and the whole thinking about evil. I've got to figure out how to balance a healthy respect for evil.
Exactly.
Without falling to being totally living in fear and hiding and not putting myself out there to do the good things that need to be done.
Yeah. What does a struggling spiritual human being do about evil? I mean, we can't dismiss it, but we can't live in fear either. So what role does the acknowledgement of evil have in our lives?
Well, I mean, I think it's like calling the question. I mean, it's saying, it's acknowledging that we have no personal control over evil on a large scale, but that there are certain small acts, one of them, and I don't think it's that small, being routine, intentional prayer, about the world, circumstances, evil in life, all those things. But that there are some practices in our lives that we can start and then start over if we stop and start over again and again, that really can be a part of changing things. Now, I am a person of hope. Do I hope and believe that within my lifetime all evil will be gone? No, because I don't think that's the world created by God. I don't think that's how we're intended to live. But I do think we are called to do what we can to make the life that we're given on earth, with all the complexity of it, as good as it can be.
Right, right. We must afford evil, it's, you know, for lack of a better word, mystery. But I think goodness always has to come first. We have to lead with love, because evil can't stand up to love.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the most important part of the quotation you read is, in my opinion, is the first principle of goodness, it would seem, is to accord evil a healthy respect. You know? And so that means you do things to stay away from it to the best of your abilities. You do things
right.
to stand in opposition to it. And
right.
sometimes, Lori, I think that means that you turn off the 6 o'clock news, because even it letting it be introduced into your mind is part of the problem. That doesn't mean you remain in ignorance, but I do think we have to begin to be more selective about the information we take in, how we take it in, what the source of it is, you know? I mean, I'm not sure the evening news is always the best way to get it.
Yeah, and I can't think of a better way to end the show than on that note. So let's do that. That's our show for this week, everybody. Come on back next week. We'll have something new. And until then, if you're looking for God, just open a book.
Have a great week. Happy Thanksgiving.